Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you every day with important stories from around the world. And we present them slowly and with words that are easy to understand. It is a great way to learn and improve your American English skills. Today we are talking politics. Ann Ball introduces us to a U.S. Senator from Vermont who is different from what most Americans have come to expect in a candidate for this nation's highest office. There is a lot of information to come, so let's move aside and give the microphone to Anne.
When Bernie Sanders announced that he was seeking the Democratic nomination, few people noticed. Senator Sanders represents Vermont, a state with the second smallest population in the United States. He is not even a registered Democrat, but an independent in Congress. Senator Sanders has white hair, and he hunches his shoulders and his body when he walks and speaks to a crowd. There is a slightly rumpled look about him. At 74 years old, Bernie Sanders is also the oldest candidate for president. But he seems to get bigger by the day. He fills large halls and stadiums. Nearly 30,000 people went to see him in Portland, Oregon, 27,000 in Los Angeles, 15,000 in Seattle, and 11,000 in Phoenix, Arizona. His supporters use the phrase "feel the burn" to promote him. It is a play on the word burn that sounds like burn and means something is on fire. And they are giving him money, plenty of it. Bernie Sanders raised almost as much money as frontrunner Hillary Clinton in the past 3 months. She raised $28 million. He brought in $26 million, mostly in small donations from individuals. David Axelrod is a former advisor for President Obama. He tweeted that Sanders' fundraising is remarkable. He added, "It is very possible that Mr. Sanders has more money available than Ms. Clinton." Kyle Condick is with the University of Virginia Center for Politics. He says Bernie Sanders appeals to Democratic voters for at least two reasons.
And so he is, one, he's not Hillary Clinton, and two, he's more liberal than Hillary Clinton. And there's certainly a desire for that amongst at least some Democratic voters.
Most political observers, including Mr. Condick, say Mr. Sanders probably cannot win the Democratic nomination. They say he is too liberal, too far to the left politically, and too old to win. Early in the campaign, he had problems with supporters from the Black Lives Matter movement. That movement fights against racism, especially how police sometimes respond differently to darker-skinned people than lighter. Since then, he has reached out to Black voters, a key voting group. In recent months, Senator Sanders has climbed in the polls. They show him leading in New Hampshire, a small northeastern American state next to Vermont. it will hold the first primary in the nation on February 9, 2016. But across the nation, support for Hillary Clinton is still 16 points higher in the polls. The process of nominating a candidate in the U.S. is complex. Not everyone in the U.S. understands how it works. About 4,500 delegates will attend the Democratic National Convention next July. Among them are 700 party leaders, also known as superdelegates. The party leaders have more influence in the process to nominate a candidate for president. Ms. Clinton's campaign says she has the endorsement of most of those party leaders. Mr. Kondik explains why Democratic Party leaders support Ms. Clinton.
Hardly any of those people support Sanders because they don't think he could win a general election and they think he's too liberal.
However, those superdelegates can change their votes up to the last minute of voting at the convention. Paul Heintz is the political editor for 7 Days newspaper in Senator Sanders' hometown of Burlington, Vermont. He has covered Bernie Sanders for years. Like many people, he says Mr. Sanders is doing far better in this race than expected. Mr. Heintz says not all Democrats favor Hillary Clinton. Critics question why she used a private, unofficial email server when she was Secretary of State. Many people like Mr. Sanders' economic message, says Paul Heintz. Americans are still hurting from the 2008 financial crisis that caused unemployment and loss of assets.
And though the number of jobs are coming back, the amount that people are being paid hasn't quite come back. So a number of people are feeling, many people are feeling tremendous economic insecurity. And Senator Sanders' message has always been focused on that.
Authentic is a word often used to describe Mr. Sanders. People say he is authentic, which means real and not a fake personality. Kyle Condit says that Bernie Sanders lacks the same style or positive messaging of successful past presidential candidates, candidates like Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama.
Sanders' speaking style is very blunt, very direct, and his stump speech is almost just this big criticism of the country and how we have problems with income inequality and other issues of fairness that are legitimate points to make. But I think that his speaking style is frankly kind of a downer.
Bernie Sanders, like Republican frontrunner Donald Trump, has talked about improving the economy. Mr. Trump says he would cut taxes for wealthy people and businesses. Mr. Sanders says he would raise taxes on them. Both have captured attention by running as outsiders. While Bernie Sanders appears to be an outsider, he has had a long political career. It started when he was elected mayor of Burlington, Vermont in 1981, getting 10 votes more than his opponent. In 1990, he was elected to the House of Representatives representing Vermont. As a registered independent, he did not belong to either party and had few successes. Mr. Heintz says,
in his time in Congress, he has never really been a major player, and that's in part because he hasn't been a member of the Democratic Party, and he hasn't sort of played by the conventional rules.
He was elected to the Senate in 2006 As chairman of the Veterans Affairs Committee, he worked with Republican Senator John McCain to improve health care for military veterans. Bernie Sanders grew up in an apartment in Brooklyn, New York. He is Jewish, but says he does not follow the religion closely. If elected president, he would be the first Jew elected to the highest office in the U.S. I'm Ann Ball.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. The winner of the 2015 Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences studies how people spend their money. He also has explored how spending can affect both living conditions and poverty. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences is presenting the Economics Prize to Professor Angus Deaton of Princeton University in New Jersey. The Nobel Committee says his research has mainly dealt with three questions. How do consumers distribute their spending among different goods? How much of society's wealth is spent and how much is saved? And how do we best measure and study well-being and poverty? Mr. Deaton used household surveys to collect detailed information about how families spent their money. For example, in one study, the Princeton professor examined the relationship between poverty and the amount of calories in the food people ate. The Nobel Committee said Mr. Deaton's research has shown how the clever use of household data can shed light on issues such as the relationship between income and calorie intake, and the extent of gender discrimination with the family. The Princeton professor was asked why he paid so much attention to household information. Mr. Deaton said that his studies were mainly about people and their behavior.
Well, you know, it's individually, it's about people in the end. And if you're going to understand, you have to understand what makes people tick, and you have to understand, you know, what's good for them. And for me, it's always been about trying to understand behavior and to try to infer from that behavior, you know, how people are doing.
The Nobel Committee also praised Mr. Deaton's work because it used detailed information about real people, not theoretical ideas. Subjects of his research have included happiness, well-being, and aging. At a press conference this week, the Nobel Prize winner said he was pleased that his work had been recognized. He told reporters he believed poverty would decrease. I think we've had a remarkable decrease for the past 20 to 30 years. I do expect that to continue, he said. Mr. Deaton is a citizen of both the United States and Britain. He was born in Scotland. He has served as a professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton since 1983. The Economics Prize has been offered by Sweden's central bank in memory of Alfred Nobel since 1969. It is valued this year at $978,000. And that's the Economics Report. I'm Mario Ritter.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember. 1852 was a presidential election year in the United States. The Democratic Party held its nominating convention in Baltimore, Maryland. The meeting opened in June of 1852. Delegates agreed that a man must win two-thirds of the convention's votes to be the Democratic candidate. On the first ballot, no one received two-thirds of the vote, so the voting continued. Finally, on the 47th ballot, support began to increase for someone considered an unlikely candidate. His name was Franklin Pierce. Pierce was from the northeastern state of New Hampshire. He was a lawyer and former state lawmaker. He also had served in the United States Senate and House of Representatives. He became an officer in the Army during the U.S. War with Mexico. On the 49th ballot, Pierce won the Democratic nomination. He would be the party's candidate for president.
Pierce was a passionately loyal adherent of the Democratic Party and of its principles of negative governance domestically and spread eagle expansionism in foreign affairs.
Historian Michael Holt wrote a book about Franklin Pierce. Mr. Holt describes Pierce as someone who was like most Democrats at the time. In other words, he did not think the federal government should intervene much in efforts to help build up and develop the nation. But he wanted the United States to play a big and powerful role internationally. Naturally, Democrats did not agree on every policy issue. In 1852, the party was sharply divided on whether the government should or could permit slavery to continue in the United States. But Democrats decided to limit their fighting with each other during the election campaign, and they all agreed to support Pierce. The Whig Party held its presidential nominating convention in Baltimore 2 weeks after the Democrats met. The same thing that happened at the Democratic convention now happened at the Whig convention. Delegates voted over and over again, but no man got enough votes to win. It took 53 ballots before one of the men, General Winfield Scott, won the nomination. On election day, Pierce won a crushing victory. The Democrats won not only the presidency, but also strong majorities in Congress. The Democrats' victory was so great that many people thought the Whig Party was finished. In fact, many Whigs themselves hoped their party was destroyed. Like the Democrats, Whigs disagreed with each other about slavery. Northern Whigs wanted to form a new anti-slavery party, and Southern Whigs wanted to form a party that would better represent their interests. The Whigs lost badly in the 1852 elections because, unlike the Democrats, they were not able to bridge the differences between their Northern and Southern members. Franklin Pierce was 48 years old when he took office. He was the youngest man yet to be elected president. He was charming and made friends easily, but those who knew Pierce best worried about him. They knew that under all his friendly charm, he was a weak man. They feared the duties and problems of the presidency would be too great for him to deal with. Pierce also faced a difficult situation in his personal life. Two of his children had died when they were babies. A third child was killed in a train accident shortly before Pierce moved to the White House. In addition, his wife, Jane, did not like living in Washington, D.C. She did not support her husband's campaign for presidency. Years earlier, she had urged him to resign from the Senate and return to New Hampshire. She did not want to go back to Washington. When her husband was elected, she agreed to live there, but she rarely saw anyone. One of her close friends took her place at public events. Historian Michael Holt says Franklin Pierce's main goal as president was to keep his party united. One way to maintain party unity was to adopt popular Democratic policies. He promised strong support for expanding the territory of the United States. He also promised a strong foreign policy. During his term in office, Pierce successfully negotiated with Britain to gain American fishing rights along the coast of Canada. He also supported diplomatic and trade talks with Japan. However, he was unsuccessful in an attempt to buy Cuba from Spain. National issues presented President Pierce with a more difficult problem. Now that the election was over, some Democrats felt it was time once again to raise the issue of slavery. The Compromise of 1850 had settled the question of slavery only in the Western territories. But anti-slavery activists said the compromise should have done more to end slavery throughout the country. And pro-slavery activists said the agreement did not protect slave owners' rights. They did not want the federal government to intervene in slavery anywhere. As president in 1853, Pierce had to choose between the competing sides. He could support the Compromise of 1850 and say the dispute over slavery was settled. Or Pierce could try to make peace with both anti- and pro-slavery extremists. Giving the extremists jobs in his administration would be the easy way to satisfy their demands. And that was the policy Pierce chose.
Contemporaries at the time predicted that this attempt to share the plums would wreck the party, and it did.
Historian Michael Holt says Pierce sought to include men from competing sides of the Democratic Party in his cabinet. Pierce named William Marcy of New York as Secretary of State. Marcy wanted to limit the spread of slavery and keep the Union together. Jefferson Davis of Mississippi was named Secretary of War. Davis, more than any other man, represented Southern slave owners. He threatened to take the South out of the Union if the government set any limits on slavery. Caleb Cushing of Massachusetts was named Attorney General. Although a Northerner, Cushing was a friend of many Southerners. He was a very able man, but his loyalties were not clear. James Buchanan of Pennsylvania was named Minister to Britain. All these men had strong ideas about the future of the United States. President Pierce found it difficult to control them. One senator even said the administration should not have been called the Pierce administration because Pierce did not lead it. He said it was an administration of enemies of the Union who used the president's name and power for their own purposes. As president, Franklin Pierce faced another difficult question. Where should the United States build its new railroads? The country had expanded, and white settlers were moving west. Many were hungry for good transportation. They wanted railroads that reached across the continent from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean. Engineers decided that four new rail lines would be possible. They could cross the southern, central, or northern parts of the United States. Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas, a Democrat, proposed that three of the lines be built. He said the government could give land to the railroad companies. The companies could then sell the land to get the money they needed to build the lines. A Senate committee discussed the issue. Its members proposed that only one railroad line be built. But which one? Many congressmen believed a southern line would be best. There would be little snow in winter, and the railroad would cross lands that were already organized as states or official territories. A northern or central line would face severe winter weather, and it would have to cross a large, wild area called Nebraska. Nebraska was neither a state nor a territory. As a result, it did not yet have a local government that could support a railroad. In addition, many congressmen did not want Nebraska to develop a government. The reason, once again, was slavery. Michael Holt says members of President Pierce's party hoped the effort to organize Nebraska would unite Democrats once again. Instead, Mr. Holt says the Nebraska Territory caused more conflicts and ruined Pierce's administration. The bill increased divisions between Democrats and Whigs and between pro-slavery activists and anti-slavery abolitionists, and it brought the country one step closer to civil war. As one Northerner wrote, it was said hundreds of years ago that a house divided against itself cannot stand. The truth of this saying is written on every page in history. It is likely that the history of our own country may offer fresh examples to teach this truth to future ages. The bitter dispute over Nebraska will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.